Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a report just released on the eve of the Geneva II peace talks by three leading war crimes and human rights prosecutors documenting industrial-scale killing of prisoners by Syria's Assad regime. The former medical director for the American Refugee Committee, Stephen Miles, a professor of medicine and bioethics at the University of Minnesota, where he is on the faculty of the Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies, joins us. We will discuss the 55,000 photographs provided by a Syrian military police photographer whose job was to document the deaths by torture of 11,000 detainees for the Assads to show them that their orders had been executed. Then we'll examine the latest riots in Ukraine that have prompted Russia's foreign minister to accuse European governments of meddling in Ukraine's political crisis. A specialist on Ukraine, Russia, and the USSR, Alexander Motel, a professor of political science at Rutgers University, joins us to discuss the Yanukovych regime's use of paid thugs, tatushki, to beat up peaceful demonstrators and provoke violence that allows the regime's and Russia's state television to broadcast images of burning buses and shops being looted to make the case for tough legislation and police action to stop the violence. Then finally, we'll do an update on an interview I did in October of last year with ex-CIA officer Robert Baer that first raised the question of whether or not Edward Snowden is a Russian intelligence asset who has been working for them all along. On Sunday's Meet the Press, the head of the House Intelligence Committee made a similar charge that Snowden stole a trove of secrets that had nothing to do with privacy and that it's no coincidence that Snowden ended up in the hands, the loving arms, of an FSB agent in Moscow. Robert Baer, a veteran CIA operations officer, joins us to analyze the evidence that might support these charges. And joining us now is Stephen Miles, who's a professor of medicine and bioethics at the University of Minnesota Medical School in Minneapolis. He is on the faculty for the Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies and for the law school's concentration in health law and bioethics. He served as a medical director for the American Refugee Committee for 25 years, which included service as chief medical officer for 45,000 refugees on the Thai-Cambodian border and projects in Sudan, Croatia, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Indonesia, and the Thai-Burmese border. He is on the board of the Center for Victims of Torture, and his books include The Hippocratic Oath and the Ethics of Medicine and Oath Betrayed, America's Torture Doctors. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Miles.
Nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
And a report has just come out from three former war crimes prosecutors, Sir Desmond De Silva, the former chief prosecutor for the Special Court for Sierra Leone, Sir Geoffrey Nice, the former lead prosecutor of former Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic, and Professor David Crane, who indicted President Charles Taylor of Liberia at the Sierra Leone court. They have released a report having debriefed a Syrian military police photographer who supplied 55,000 pictures of the killings or the corpses of 11,000 detainees in what the prosecutors describe as industrial-scale killing by the Assad regime, reminiscent of World War II concentration camps of Belsen and Auschwitz. Have you looked at this report?
I've looked at the report and I've looked at the photographs, and this is an impressive human rights report. It's extraordinarily well documented.
So what are the implications then, given that this is on the eve of the Geneva II conference in Switzerland, at which the Assad regime will be meeting with the rebels? And the timing seems coincidental.
Right. The report actually shows industrial-style killing more on the range of what happened in Serbia under the Milosevic regime. Apparently what they're doing is taking prisoners and subjecting these prisoners to enormous deprivation. I was impressed by the degree of starvation of the bodies, in addition to various beatings and then a form of ligature strangulation in which bands are put around their necks. The abuses are horrendous, and they essentially mean that Assad's intention to run for re-election in a free and fair election is off the table. The question here is the issue whether he can have a negotiated retirement without being imprisoned for war crimes.
So the U.S. did not want Iran to attend the talks because, in Geneva, because they hadn't signed the Geneva One protocols, which involve easing Assad out or regime change. Now, the U.N. Invited Iran, and then the rebels said, we're not going to show up if Iran does, because they're paying for and their Revolutionary Guards are in fact, saving the Assad regime. So it looked like what happened in the end was that the UN decided that it was either going to be Iran or the rebels, and it was more important for the rebels to show up since they're half of the problem. Is that a summary?
I think that's a fair summary. The other issue is, of course, that the Iran regime itself has its own extensive record of torture and prisons. And at some point, the question of the accelerating pace of the prosecutions in real time of government leaders, including Doe and Milosevic, is something that is an issue for Iran as well as for Syria.
So it seems as though this does have echoes of the Nazi death camps with Dr. Mengele. And you are a medical doctor. And by the way, I spoke with a medical doctor fairly recently who's escaped from Syria. And she was telling me that her colleagues, when the revolution first began, they were rounded up by the regime and tortured. And when they were let out of prison, they were on their way out. The prison doctor injected them with AIDS or hepatitis, giving them a terminal disease. And that seems to be the Syrian military photographer. His job was to document all of these corpses, and apparently he paid a huge psychological price for doing this work. And the reason he was documenting the torture and the bodies was that the regime wanted these for their files, if you will, but they also wanted to provide the families with a death certificate without having to show them the body. So in other words, his job was to confirm to the regime that the orders had been carried out and these people had been killed, at the same time provide photographs that would prevent the families from viewing the bodies. So how does this strike you?
Doctors are intimately tied up with torture around the world, and one can see a map of this at doctorswhotorture.com. But the doctors have several functions in torture. Number one, they falsify medical records and death certificates to conceal the torture, and that seems to have been the purpose of this effort. The second thing that doctors do is for people who aren't supposed to die, they allow the torture to be titrated in a way that will not kill the prisoner. And in regimes that don't leave scar torture, and this is not the Assad regime strategy, they devise methods of torture that doesn't leave scars. Now, the Assad regime seems to be using its medical system simply to create medical evidence and to falsify death certificates and to deny that torture occurs. This is only one use, though, of torture in the medical regime by the Assad regime, which also was invading hospitals during the early part of the street riots in Syria, and were torturing people in the hospitals while forcing the medical persons to stand by and watch.
And is this documented as well?
This is well documented, and there's an extensive photographic evidence of this taken by cell phones in these hospitals that can easily be found online.
So this evidence that you've just suggested had been compiled earlier when the regime was going into hospitals and those that were wounded and shot in the first street protests were tortured openly, and that was recorded. And now we have this defector codenamed Caesar, who's shown up with 55,000 photographs. His job was to document the bodies as they came out of Assad's prisons, 11,000 people that he'd documented, and apparently this caused a psychological weight on him, and apparently he had defected to the opposition and provided this photographic evidence, which three very, very highly regarded former human rights prosecutors now have. Will this be forwarded to the International Criminal Court?
I'm sure that it will be forwarded to the International Criminal Court, which is already looking at the issue on Assad. The question of whether this rises to the level of genocide is a somewhat separate question, but it certainly represents crimes against humanity, and it certainly represents torture. And in the past, say 30 years ago, Assad might have been given a villa somewhere, say in Saudi Arabia, to retire to and escape prosecution in exchange for allowing for an orderly transfer of power. These types of deals are becoming much less common. It was done, for example, with Papa Doc and with Idi Amin. And now the question, I think, for President Assad is essentially going to be the question of how he hands over power with essentially no guarantees on escaping a war crimes indictment.
So are there places that he could go to?
Yeah, it is possible. I can imagine a circumstance under which, for example, Russia might agree to take Syria in, or possibly Iran, both of which have been supporting the regime against the insurgents, and essentially airlifting him out as some sort of interim government came in. It's an interesting possibility. It certainly wouldn't be the type of negotiated amnesty. It would be essentially an evacuation.
And the idea that this is an industrial-style killing, as this report suggests, does have echoes, of course, of going back to the Nazis. Have you seen anything since the Holocaust in Nazi Germany of industrial-scale killing? You mentioned Serbia.
We've had a number of instances of killing on this scale, and this is not on the scale of the Nazis. This is more on the level of Serbia. It's not on the scale of Cambodia. It's more on the level of, say, China or Zimbabwe or possibly Sudan. But this is, I think it's easy to go to the Nazi analogy right away because we think of the Nazi analogy, but around 120 countries practice torture. This is more more on the scale of Serbia or Iran, something like that.
Well, apparently this defector, the military police photographer who took all of these pictures, that was his job, to document those that were killed, to show the regime that the orders had been carried out, and to provide their family with a picture as opposed to viewing the corpse, and the regime would tell the family that he died from a heart attack. Caesar told these human rights lawyers that he, along with a doctor and a member of the judiciary, would examine the corpses. So there again you have more evidence of the medical profession being deeply involved in the regime's human rights abuses.
Absolutely. The medical regime seems to be heavily involved, and that's not a surprise. The other thing that's not a surprise is the obsessive documentation of human rights abuses of these torturing regimes. We're seeing, for example, these documents surfacing and being used very effectively in prosecutions currently happening in Guatemala and also in Brazil and Argentina. And I don't know what it is about these satanic dictators. They just love to keep detailed records. The Nazis, of course, were very good at keeping records, and that was part of the enormous museum called the Vod in Israel.
But my understanding is that the Assad regime were able to convince the world for the longest time that he was a modernizing force. He was a medical doctor practicing in London when he was recalled to take over the family dynasty, political dynasty. And he His wife, for example, was featured in Vogue magazine in a big fluff piece saying how what a great fashion icon she was and how she was modernizing Syria. So presumably that was their PR effort up until this war began. And this war began because of their actions. They were the ones who decided to kill their people rather than allow their people to have democracy or have some semblance of democracy. So is he vulnerable or does he not care? I mean, I'm not asking you to psychoanalyze this guy, but, you know, give me a sense of this contradiction between this so-called modern family and what they do in their own dungeons.
I think it's a fascinating question. Of course, to some degree, the glamorization of these dictators is easy because glamour is public and the torture is secret. But what's so fascinating about the Assad case is that in most regimes now, they've switched to non-scarifying, non-disfiguring torture in order to not create a graphic public record. And this is done to preserve the semblance of democracy. For example, the question of using suffocation methods, false executions, that kind of thing. But by Assad shifting to scarifying torture and mutilating torture in the manner that he's done, basically what he's done is he said that I'm not interested in the possibility of a transition to a democratic form of government. I'm going to maintain my government by fascist types of power and fear. And so the regimes that use non-scarifying torture tend to be the ones that want to maintain the pretense of democracy.
So you're suggesting here, Stephen Miles, that, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that this is hardly a coincidence that this report came out. I think this fellow, Caesar, defected some time ago on the eve of the Geneva II talks,
right,
and that Assad, you know, basically is in a situation where he won't be able to. I mean, his bottom line in these negotiations is my tenure is not negotiable. And up until the rebels agreed to go to Geneva under pressure from the U.S. and the U.N., they were saying that, you know, Assad continuing is not negotiable. So somehow they're going to try and finesse this in these talks. What do you think is going to come out of these talks if indeed, as you say, at the end of the day, Assad will probably end up in Russia?
Well, I think that one of the things that this report has done is it has removed the possibility of another election to serve as a plebiscite on the Assad regime, and that essentially Assad now has the option not so much of an amnesty, but a flat-out escape and concealment in the countries of some of his supporters. And so that the option for the Geneva conference has dropped from three options, that is, escape, another attempted election or transition government, to two. He can do an escape, or there'll be a transition without an escape, in which case he winds up looking like El Duce hanging from a meat hook out in the public square.
Well, Stephen Miles, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Stephen Miles, who's a professor of medicine and bioethics at the University of Minnesota Medical School. He's on the faculty for the Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies and for the law school's concentration in health law and bioethics, and served as medical director for the American Refugee Committee for 25 years, including service on the Thai-Cambodian border, Sudan, Croatia, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Indonesia, and the Thai-Burmese border. He is on the board of the Center for Victims of Torture, and his books include The Hippocratic Oath and the Ethics of Medicine, and Oath Betrayed, America's Torture Doctors. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into the new round of protests in the Ukraine.
There's a woman on my block. She just sit there facing the hill. She say, who gonna take away his license to kill? Now he's helping for destruction. He's afraid and confused, and his brain has been mismanaged with great skill.
the crime. In jail time, in jail time, in jail time, it was not a crime.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Alexander Motel, who's a professor of political science at Rutgers University, as well as a writer and painter. He previously served as associate director of the Harriman Institute at Columbia University. He's a specialist on Ukraine, Russia, and the USSR, and on nationalism, revolutions, empires, and theory. He's the author of a number of books, including Dilemmas of Independence, Ukraine After Totalitarianism, and The Turn to the Right, The Ideological Origins and Development of Ukrainian Nationalism, 1919 to 1929. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alexander Motel.
Very happy to be with you again.
And the Russian foreign minister is now castigating European leaders for what they say is meddling in the Ukraine, referring to visits in December by the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State and the EU's foreign policy chief, Catherine Ashton. But these demonstrations that are taking place now apparently are being organized by either the regime or the Russians, and they're hiring thugs as provocateurs to do the very damage that the Russians are complaining about.
Well, but remember, yes and no. The fact of the matter is, the revolution, as it's called, has been going on for the last 2 months, and downtown Kiev has been barricaded by the democratic protesters in so-called Independence Square, and they've been there demanding initially that the association agreement with Europe be signed. And then since then, their demands have escalated. And at this point, they're essentially demanding that the government resign, that Yanukovych go, and that there be a complete overhaul of the political system. What then happened this particular weekend was that it was last Thursday, the 16th of January, the majority party in the parliament, the Party of Regions, they called together some 100 or so of their delegates. They held a rump session that lasted about 15 minutes. They were far from a quorum, and they simply pushed through several pieces of extremely repressive legislation that would essentially transform Ukraine into a kind of North Korea, almost. They were going to control the internet. They intend to control the internet. They were going to, people would get years or months of imprisonment for publicly meeting, expressing their opinions. libel would have been reintroduced, all these sorts of things that haven't been in Ukraine for a number of years. That led to protests over the weekend. And as part of the protests, a radical group within the opposition — these weren't provocateurs. It's been claimed that they're provocateurs, but they haven't been, actually. A radical group within the opposition decided to fight fire with fire. And they took to firebombing some of the riot police vehicles, and they engaged in some physical conflicts with them. But the impetus for the violence, the immediate impetus for the violence were these repressive laws. And then, of course, the longer-term impetus for the violence was that for the last 2 months, the regime has been beating up, pillaging, burning the vehicles of democratic protesters throughout the country, virtually on a daily basis. A number of individuals have been disappeared. Several individuals were found dead. Many have disappeared, and their whereabouts are still unknown. So essentially what the regime did was create a situation of a kind of spiraling radicalization. And the ultimate, as it were, the thing that pushed everything over the edge, so to speak, was this series of legislation. And significantly, one of the elements of the legislation was that it forbade the wearing of masks and helmets in protest actions. And, of course, the only reason people would wear helmets during protest actions was precisely because they feared getting beaten over the head by the riot police. And importantly, during the mass demonstrations this weekend, people wore masks and helmets. Everybody. The whole point was that no one is listening to the legislation. People are rejecting it, and people are simply declaring that they've had enough of the regime. And then, of course, within this context, you did have these hotheads who went out and engaged in this kind of violent activity. Now, the regime, of course, has taken advantage of that, and now they're saying, they're all terrorists, they're all individuals who are simply out to overthrow the regime. And since the regime controls the public television stations, what they're doing is showing footage of burning vehicles and failing to show footage of the hundreds of peaceful democratic activists who've been hurt by concussion grenades, those stun grenades, by rubber bullets. A number of individuals have lost their lives. What the militia, what the riot police are doing as well is they're taking stun grenades and they're tying them to rocks, and then they're throwing them into the crowds. And the result of that is that the grenade is then exploding the rock and then sending out the rock as a form of shrapnel. I'm not sure if that's a war crime. That's certainly an inhumane act and seems to violate all sorts of ethical considerations. But in any case, none of that, of course, is being shown on television. The burning vehicles are being shown on television. Personally, I don't think that's going to affect anybody's opinions, because the people who believe that the regime are right, which is roughly 30% of the population, will believe that the regime are right even if Christ were to come down from heaven and declare that the regime is wrong. And the two-thirds of the population that detests the regime believes that the regime is wrong, regardless of what the regime says or does. So it's just a war of images and a war of words. The reality on the ground, however, is that the situation has markedly radicalized. And what began initially as a call simply for a move towards the European Union is now essentially become a vast, vast social movement that encompasses geographically about two-thirds to three-quarters of Ukraine and encompasses millions of people who are absolutely determined to overthrow the current government and replace it with a democratic system.
But the peaceful protesters have blamed a lot of this violence on a little-known far-right group called Right Sector. And the former boxing champion, Vitali Klitschko, he and others have charged that the government is paying thugs, nicknamed Tatushki, to delegitimize these protests. And the BBC, by the way, have spoken to several of these Tatushki who the opposition have detained, and they have said that they were told to show up at a certain place and they were given weapons like hammers. And another one said he was doing it for the money after seeing an offer online, and that he had been instructed to stir up trouble. So it does seem that the regime is wanting to get these pictures, and the Russian television apparently keeps playing them over and over again.
Oh, sure. I mean, well, listen, just starting with your final point, I mean, the Russian TV has been misrepresenting so egregiously the developments in Kyiv as to be, I mean, it's just scandalous. I mean, they've been presenting every single action that's been taking place in Kyiv over the last 2 months has been presented as some kind of fascist aggression, which is absolutely absurd. But in terms of the Tatushki, now, you're absolutely right. These are individuals, you know, guys roughly somewhere in their late teens, early 20s. They often have this kind of sporty quality to them. That is to say, they look like guys who work out a lot at gyms or hang out at sports clubs. You know, short hair, that kind of thing. And they've been driven into Kyiv from all over the country. They're given some money, and they're told to stir up trouble. they've been hanging out near or around Independence Square since the very beginning of these demonstrations at the end of November. What they've usually done is assail people, Democratic activists and others, somewhere in the outskirts of the of Independence Square. Occasionally, they try to assault the actual square, but these guys are fundamentally, I mean, they're not committed to anything. So, when some of the Democrats say "boo," they just run away. But they're there to cause trouble, and what they were doing this particular weekend, I mean, they were mobilized, and they started patrolling the streets of Kiev at night. Now, this is relatively new, as far as I recall. So they came en masse. This was on Sunday, and yesterday as well, I believe. They came out en masse in downtown Kiev, and they were just patrolling the streets, looking for activists and beating them up, burning their cars, all those sorts of things. And that led then to the Democratic activists to try to round up these guys and get rid of them. And there's now talk within the Democratic camp of actually setting up certain kinds of formalized self-defense units that would patrol Kiev and try to keep these tatushkis out of the areas of the Democratic protesters. Now, it's perfectly possible that some of these guys were involved in these activities on Sunday. I wouldn't be surprised. Although, frankly, I do think these were radicals. And it's perfectly possible that they were also involved in some of the other more or less violent activities that had taken place in late November. But the tatushkis' primary function is to intimidate. I mean, they're hired thugs. That's the point. That's the thing to keep in mind. They're there to intimidate. They're there to cause trouble. And, of course, they also serve a very useful function because they can beat up Democratic activists, and the government can then insist, well, look, we're not beating you up. It's the wrath of the people. The people are upset by your instability, by your activism. We're trying to reestablish law and order. So they're very convenient for the government. They can pass off a lot of the dirty work onto these kids, well, onto these thugs, if you prefer.
So, Alexander Myrtle, the president of the Ukraine, Viktor Yanukovych, he apparently is running a kleptocracy involving his family. His oldest son apparently basically goes to all of the Ukraine's oligarchs and the billionaires and says, I'm now your new partner. And this apparently really riles up the people. It's bad enough having, you know, corrupt oligarchs dominating your economy, but to have these parasites in government basically fleecing them is apparently too much for the people. And we've seen this before in other cases. Tunisia, that riot, the Arab Spring began with the people's revulsion against the ruling family's tacky excess, shall we say. Is that the case in the Ukraine?
Absolutely. Yanukovych has turned into a kind of Ukrainian Ceausescu or Saddam Hussein. It's simply astounding how much money he and his sons have amassed. He himself has this lavish palace, which he essentially stole from the state outside of Kiev. Included on the grounds of the palace is this lavish, it's a clubhouse. It's the equivalent of a McMansion. He has a galleon. I'm not kidding. It's a galleon. It's a boat. It's a ship that serves as a reception area with gold-plated toilet seats. I mean, this is just absurd. His son, who was a dentist, his older son, the dentist, has become one of Ukraine's richest men in 3 years. One of his leading cronies, a guy by the name of Kurchenko, had zero capital assets 3 years ago and now has $3 billion worth in assets. And this entire cabal, they're referred to as the Yanukovych family, it's the family proper plus a bunch of their closest cronies, are worth billions of dollars. The Swedish-American economist Anders Aslund estimates that they've skimmed off roughly $10 to $15 billion of money from the Ukrainian GDP in the last 3 years. That's astounding. That's simply astounding. This is money that could have gone to hospitals, schools, roads, and things like that. And, of course, one way in which they've done this is simply by shakedowns. It's that simple. It's a mafia regime. The deal is, if you want to establish an enterprise, buy something, do something, the family gets 15%. That's the word on the street, 15%. If you don't agree to the 15%, you're out of business. It's as simple as that. And alternatively, if they come in and you do have a business and they offer you a price that you can't refuse, and any price that they offer you can't refuse, you're out of business as well. This is the remarkable thing about this regime. It is a gangster regime. And, of course, for the majority of for the Ukrainian population, this is unacceptable. It's not just that the oligarchs control 80 to 85% of the GDP, but the president, who is supposedly the individual who's supposed to defend the security and prosperity of the population, is actually out oligarching the oligarchs. This is pure, you know, this is rapine and repression, pure and simple. So not surprising that millions have been protesting over the last 2 months. And it's very likely, I'd say it's quite certain, that the protests will continue for the foreseeable future. People are fed up. People are simply fed up. And more important, they're no longer afraid. And when you're fed up and you're no longer afraid, you're not going to go home all that easily.
Well, just in closing, I suppose it's no surprise that Putin supports the regime. Obviously, Russia has geopolitical interests and their, you know, paranoia about NATO and the EU expanding eastward bothers them. But it does, I mean, Putin essentially regulates the oligarchs, and apparently he shakes them down. Supposedly, he'll retire as the richest person on the planet. But I guess Putin is not quite as brazen as Yanukovych.
He doesn't seem to, although I mean, I've seen estimates that he has $40 billion stashed away, which is pretty good for some, you know, 14 years of work. But he seems to have more class. He seems to understand that if you're going to steal, you should stash it away and not show it off. And by the same token, by virtue of the fact that he's got access to all this oil and gas money, he can actually spread some of the filthy lucre around and provide citizens with some degrees of improvements and infrastructure and things like that. Yanukovych just doesn't care. He's kind of the Robert Mugabe of Ukraine. He just takes all the money, and if the people are getting poorer in the process, who cares?
Well, Alexander Model, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Alexander Model, who's a professor of political science at Rutgers University, as well as a writer and painter. He previously served as associate director of the Harriman Institute at Columbia University. He's a specialist on the Ukraine, Russia, and the USSR, and on nationalism, revolutions, empires, and theory. And he's the author of a number of books, including Dilemmas of Independence, Ukraine After Totalitarianism, and The Turn to the Right, The Ideological Origins and Development of Ukrainian Nationalism, 1919 to 1929. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into charges by the heads of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees suggesting Edward Snowden has been working for the Russians all along. I'm a secret agent, man. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Baer, who's a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle Eastern countries, including Iraq and Lebanon and Syria. Robert Baer is now an intelligence analyst for CNN and is the author of three New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, dealing with the new Iranian superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife Dana, is The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife True Life Spy Story. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer.
Hey, how's it going?
Well, we spoke last October, Bob, and we were the first to raise the question of whether or not Edward Snowden is a Russian intelligence asset who has been working for them all along. And this, that back in October, we were talking about stories in the New York Times that had revealed that Edward Snowden, when he was working for the CIA in Geneva, had tried to break into the computers of the Directorate of Operations, which are the most secret and tightly held database probably in the U.S. government. So let's begin with that. Your speculation back in October was, why would anybody break into the Directorate of Operations computers unless somebody asked them to do it?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the guy was clearly a security problem when he worked for the CIA. It's a no-no trying to get in these databases. It doesn't matter whether you're a systems administrator or not. It's a firing offense. Of course, the question is, why didn't the CIA alert the National Security Agency? That's something I can't answer. But I mean, there's indications here that this guy was unstable. He was looking at places he shouldn't have been looking, and the fact that he found a way into apparently 1.7 million documents from the National Security Agency, this doesn't sound to me like somebody operating on his own, especially somebody of that age. I mean, you know, the National Security Agency does have a system for monitoring this stuff, and so how did he get around it? Did he learn it on his own? There's also the question of, from a covert action perspective, it's been absolutely, it's been a gold mine for our enemies, the way this stuff's been released. In covert action, you never want to release it all at once. It gets lost. You dribble it out. You wait for the administration to make a statement saying, that's it, you've seen the worst, and then you give it something worse. The other fact is that a lot of this stuff, he's gotten into sources and methods, which goes beyond, you know, privacy issues, if that was just the question. The fact, you know, what cell phone technology can be intercepted and de-encrypted, that was another sign. Listening into Merkel's phone, for instance. It was all sort of calculated embarrassment, and it just got worse and worse. You know, this is orchestrated. You know, kid may be a genius. On the other hand, you know, being an old spook, you have to wonder whether the Russians didn't get in touch with him in Geneva or Tokyo or even Hawaii, wherever he's been. And especially if he was on the Internet, you know, going on about, you know, his beliefs, he would be a perfect recruit. I mean, that's somebody I would have looked at if he'd been a Russian.
Well, the head of the House Intelligence Oversight Committee on Sunday on Meet the Press, he made the charge that Snowden, when he was in Hawaii, when he was basically stealing most of this stuff, that he was probably working for the Russians then. But he also said that it's hardly a coincidence that Snowden ended up in the hands, the loving arms of an FSB agent in Moscow. And there, I imagine, Chairman Rogers is referring to Sarah Harrison, the WikiLeaks person who took him to the Russian consulate in Hong Kong at the time that he first broke the news and was filmed. And that's where he was hiding out when he was in Hong Kong. And Sean Wilentz, the Princeton historian, has a very provocative article in the New Republic talking about Snowden, who he really is, in terms of what Sean Wilentz has dug up, both Snowden, Greenwald, and Assange, the head of WikiLeaks. And, you know, he makes the case, or the evidence seems to point to the idea that WikiLeaks is in many ways a Russian asset. They, back in at the time before the sexual charges against Assange were released by the Swedes, WikiLeaks had promised to reveal very damaging information about Russia. And then they apparently completely changed their tune. Russia said they'd block them all together. And then in order for them to make, they apparently made a deal with the Russians not to be blocked. And then suddenly Russia turns around as their most vocal defenders in against the Swedish charges. And
well, Ian, it's just not that. He hasn't laid a hand on the Chinese or the Russians. I mean, there's clearly stuff in documents he had access to that put the Russians in a bad light or the Chinese. I mean, the National Security Agency was all over Chinese hacking, and the fact that he didn't go after them, this is very one-sided. You have to ask those questions, and the fact that the FBI has said, no, we don't see a Russian hand, it's crazy. I mean, they don't know that.
Right.
They can't prove it. That's something else.
Well, the first leak that came, apart from the metadata leak, which was about our invasion of privacy by the NSA, the first leak that came out was a presidential finding signed by Barack Obama targeting China for cyber espionage. That came out on the eve of Obama's meeting with the new Chinese leader in Palm Springs, which completely undercut Obama's negotiating position.
Yes, Ian, this is what I'm saying. The timing just stinks to high heaven.
Right.
Both against the Chinese and the Russians. And the Russians had every motivation in the world after, you know, these illegals were rolled up. And he was personally embarrassed by the spies arrested in the United States. So I don't think this is looking good. I just don't. I mean, you know, I'm overly suspicious, but it's gone beyond the metadata. And what we can't forget is, look, Snowden may be right that there's been an overreach to the National Security Agency. I have no doubt about it. I also don't doubt that people have been taking a peek into congressmen's, you know, metadata and journalists as well. And they go out and get warrants otherwise, but once they've decided who's guilty. I can't prove that, but I suspect it, and there are a lot of newspapers that suspect it. So he might be right in that regard, but that doesn't mean he can't be a bad guy also working for the Russians. They're not mutually exclusive.
Well, just to go back to the beginning of the story in Hong Kong, where Snowden, according to Izvestia and other sources that I've talked to, said that he was in the Russian consulate and he was taken there by Sarah Harrison, who apparently Mike Rogers is referring to as the loving arms of an FSB officer. The other source that I talked to about this was Bruce Fine, who was the lawyer for Lon Snowden, Snowden's father, who told me that when he was trying to get to the Sun, that they had to deal with WikiLeaks. And he said that Bruce said that WikiLeaks were getting were totally working with the Russians and on the Russian payroll. So there is, I think, need for some clarity here, particularly after the evidence that Sean Wilentz has brought forth in the New Republic. I mean, this is what frustrates me. I get slammed for even having a conversation like this because people are so absolutely tribal in their beliefs and they can't keep two thoughts in their head at the same time, that one, the guy can be a hero and a traitor. But the point is, as a journalist, we don't have access to this guy. He's totally controlled by the Russians. The only people they let talk to him are people like my friend Ray McGovern, who are not going to ask difficult questions.
The problem is on a situation like this, you never run to the Russians or the Chinese. The whistleblowing is fine. You go to Ecuador. You go to a neutral place, Iceland even. You cut your deals. And taking somebody to the Russian consulate undermines the message. I don't trust the National Security Agency. I don't want them controlling my metadata. I know that, you know, there's a possibility they're listening to my phone because I'm a critic when I'm overseas. Any sorts of things. It's a messy, messy system, and I'm glad that Snowden put it out on the record, the way this thing works, because he wasn't going after sources and methods, but now he is. And I really have a problem with Merkel. Who cares whether we listen to Merkel's phone? Ian, I can listen to your phone privately. I can listen to your. So what? It happens all the time. But the fact is that the way this was released makes me wonder about motivations. Snowden should have gone to Congress, and if they didn't do anything, is reveal this on the front steps of Capitol Hill. And that's the way to do it. And you take your licks, go to jail, whatever. That's what whistleblowers do, sort of a sacrifice. But running to the Russians, no. He undercut the message. We can only imagine what else he gave the Russians we're not even hearing about. You know, and I don't. Why should we take his word for it? He gave them nothing. Why?
Well, as I say, the problem is that, which reinforces my suspicions, is that you know nobody has access to him anymore. That Putin says that he doesn't want him to embarrass our friends. That's all he's been doing ever since, is embarrassing the U.S. and dividing the U.S. from its allies.
Why doesn't he come out against FAPSI? That's the Russian intercept people. Why hasn't he? Why has there been no criticism? Russia, listen to everything.
Right.
On their embassies, and this National Security Agency has stuff on that too, but you're not seeing a word of it.
Well, but I think that I recall when he was in Moscow, supposedly at the airport, that the reason that Putin was justified in issuing him a one-year visa, according to what Putin said, was that the Americans have basically taken his passport away and closed all of the exits. Well, the main exit was closed by a Russian leak that said he was on the president of Bolivia, I think it was, a plane. That leak came from the Russians. So it's an awfully coincidental that that leak ended up closing the door on other possibilities where Snowden could end up, so that he ends up in the hands of the Russians to debrief him.
It's just nonsense. The Russians, this is all evidence points to some sort of Russian complicity, either after the act or even before. I mean, I obviously don't know about Geneva. And I don't trust Rogers. I don't trust, you know, the right wing on this, or the Republicans, or anybody. I don't trust the administration. But I'm just talking about somebody who's being objective. It has all the smell of a covert action operation. Too slick, too professional, and it'd be one that the CIA would love to have pulled off themselves. And I just don't think we're at the end of this by any means.
Well, if we are at the beginning of it because of what Mike Rogers, the chair of the House Committee, and he's not exactly a credible source. I think he may have been the guy that – didn't he dig up those pictures of an old World War One mustard shell in Iraq to say they had WMD? I mean
– Well, it's the problem is it's the same. It's the Benghazi crowd.
Right.
There's no smoking gun on Benghazi. I mean, we all sort of know what happened there, and it was, you know, catastrophe. But when it's you get into the politics, that's what's. But I'm still waiting for some sort of real evidence before I make up my mind about Snowden.
Right.
You know, like I said, I don't. You know, he did the right thing on the metadata and the site in Utah and the rest of it. Just sort of unconscionable that we would allow this to go forward. But the Russian angle, we still don't have an answer on yet, but I suspect the worst.
Well, Dianne Feinstein, the head of the Senate Select Intelligence Committee, she was also on Meet the Press with Mike Rogers. She was a little more circumspect. But then, you know, Mike Morrell, former, was he? He was up pretty high up in the CIA. I can't remember what his position was. He's come on, I think it was CBS, saying that he agrees that this has all the earmarks of a classic Russian operation, and that Putin is laughing.
Ian, I trust Morrell. Morrell is apolitical. He was supposed to be director. Assistant director, deputy director, and somebody like that doesn't get up and say that. He's an analyst that just sort of deals in the truth.
Right.
The more we see of this, the more it suggests is some sort of Russian connection. You know, they may have dropped on their lap, but right now, if I were the Russians, I'd make sure that I held on to this guy and continue to milk it as long as they need to.
Well, then, how does a journalist find out what the hell is going on? I mean, I've tried to talk to CIA people, and they say, well, it's deep in counterintelligence, and we don't know. And you're not going to get to it. And you can't trust Rogers and the Intelligence Committee. So, you know, I've taken this story as far as I can and gotten nothing but abuse for it.
Well, don't pay any attention. This stuff on, you know, Rick Ames, the CIA mole, is all just sort of nonsense that's continued about the matrices and the rest of it, how they caught Ames. You just never get to the bottom of it. Someone's going to come out of the FBI or the CIA 10 years from now, and he's going to sit down and present facts. And, you know, unfortunately, by then, we're all going to sort of forget who Snowden was. But it just takes time, Ian.
What about some kind of pressure from the mainstream media to get to Snowden, to get and to Sarah Harrison and to Assange and to start asking these questions? I mean, the questions that are raised by Sean Wilentz in the New Republic on who both Snowden, Assange and Greenwald are, according to him, are pretty alarming. I mean, you know, the stuff that was dug up on Snowden just from his online chats. Have you heard it's unbelievable the stuff that he said about Social Security at the time of the crash in 2008. He wasn't bothered at all. He said almost everyone was self-employed prior to 1900. Why is 12% unemployment so terrifying? Save money, cut this Social Security bull. I can't use the whole word. Others were saying Social Security is BS, toss old people in the street, etc. And then Snowden says, somehow our society managed to make it hundreds of years without Social Security just fine. Magically, the world changed after the New Deal and old people became made of glass. You know, that's...
Well, he's an idiot. You know, he was living off a government contract. He'd drop out from high school and he's making over $200,000 a year. For patent, Booz Allen. I mean, you know, there's corporate welfare. I mean, this guy's just an idiot, you know. Mm. You know what he says and the rest of it. He's the worst sort of messenger on NSA. Going to Russia, going to China, his political views. We don't always get, you know, the whistleblower we want. But it doesn't mean we can't deal with the facts and entertain the possibility that the Russians have control of him and did very early on. And those are the facts that we have to deal with.
Right. Well, as I say, just in closing, I wish there was a way that you could get to this guy and ask him these questions, and particularly Sarah Harrison and Assange and all of those people. Greenwald, particularly the questions that are raised. I'm going to be talking with Sean Wilentz tomorrow, so I'll follow up on it. So I thank you for joining us, Robert Baer.
Thanks.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Baer, who is a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle Eastern countries, including Iraq and Lebanon. Robert Baer is now an intelligence analyst at CNN. He's also the author of three New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife Dana, is The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife True Life Spy Story. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.